Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're invading Afghanistan for women's rights and to get Bin Laden, the man behind 9/11. Pull the other one, lizard man. So, following on from last week's 9/11 special, we visit the country in Central Asia which got it in the neck a few weeks afterwards. Lucy Morgan Edwards was working for the United Nations and the World Food Programme in Afghanistan before and after 9/11. She's in a unique position to explain how the country was affected by the arrival of NATO and why the Afghans are now having to put up with mob rule, how their country's become a vast, lawless opium farm dotted with NATO military bases. Her book is The Afghan Solution. News today too, surprise, surprise, that NATO country Holland, specifically Dutch Foreign Minister Stefan Blok, has found the Russians guilty of shooting down Malaysian airliner MH17. It's all over the fake news here in the NATO zone, but with 300 people dead, how can the investigation be independent when conducted by a NATO country with no Russian participation? While NATO's allies, Ukraine, whose fascist leader, Andriy Perebi, is a prime suspect, maybe for ordering the plane to be shot down by his Air Force fighter, they were included in the investigation. Our sister show Dialect is back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, the Bristol campaign against tower blocks and high-rises is a response to the love-in the city is having right now with the city's property speculators and developers. Also, Manchester-based talk show host Richie Allen discusses the reaction this week to last year's arena bombing, as well as the rising star in the BBC taking over from Andrew Marr. But she is from a Manchester brothel-running mafia family of convicted criminals. Her name is Emma Barnett. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. I'll download it from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, I think probably best to start this week talking about this MH17 business because it's been in the news today. I mean, this is quite an interesting scenario here where effectively NATO countries and Ukraine are investigating a crash. The Russians are not.
Well, in actual fact, there is an international procedure for investigating these incidents, but the West has chosen not to follow that international procedure.
Why isn't it aviation?
Because they don't want to follow it.
Why is it the Dutch foreign minister making these announcements, not the aviation investigators?
Because what they've done is they've set up their own investigation based upon what they think is what they want to do, which is not, in fact, the rules of international aviation investigations, in which, of course, everybody would have some kind of a say and be able to input stuff. And the Russians, of course, have actually supplied them with lots of information that they've gathered, which has all been ignored in this result, as you might call it. Seems incredibly implausible what they're saying. They're saying that we know that the Ukraine, it probably wasn't shot down by a Buk missile, but the only Buk missiles in the zone were all Ukrainian army Buk missiles. They were actually, Soviet production.
This is not what they've said today.
They've said that a Russian missile battery came over the border, shot down the plane, and then went back over the border, although they've got no evidence for that whatsoever. But there was a fact that several Ukrainian missile batteries were in the zone. But I think the real truth of the matter is it was shot down by a plane, because BBC Russia had correspondents on the ground who got eyewitnesses to say they saw the plane being shot down by a fighter from
Kiev.
This
was actually uploaded online. It was shown.
Yes, that's right.
It
was shown in Russia, but then BBC London closed down what BBC Russia had already uncovered. And of course, none of that made it into this kangaroo court report, which we're now being forced to accept as some kind of, you know, the Russians obviously shot down the plane because that's a sort of evil thing that they do, being as evil as they are.
The pilot that the Russians have accused of flying the Sukhoi jet that shot it down, allegedly, with a cannon apparently rather than a missile, though possibly a missile too. We reported this just 2 or 3 months ago, didn't we, that he'd committed suicide.
Well, yes, he's dead. Let's put it that way. Whether he committed suicide is another question. It's very hard. My copper's hunch about all of this, and, you know, again, it's speculative. There's not been a proper investigation. There should have been a proper investigation. Dutch journalists went out there, and they gathered lots of information, which didn't cover the story that the Dutch government is now coming out with. And they had all of their material confiscated, you know, audio, video, everything confiscated when they came back from the region. And none of that, of course, made it into this
talking about
into
the Ukraine
report,
which is where all this happened. Obviously there were several things to do with this, where a strange diversion of the plane northwards, more towards the war zone, and also to ask the pilot to actually to reduce his altitude as well, in order to, I suppose, I mean, possibly to allow this plane to get to him. But the main problem here is this chap Andrei Perubi. He was the chairman of the National Security Council in Ukraine at the time, and he resigned, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, without giving any explanation. Who is this guy?
Well, he's basically a fascist operative, a big cheese in that sort of circles, but he also works very closely with NATO intelligence services, and he's become the speaker of the Ukrainian parliament, which means he can't be prosecuted for anything that he does.
Now,
but he's also heavily implicated in the trade union hall massacre in Odessa, for example.
Well, he was also the commandant of the Maidan protest.
Indeed. Also, probably, there's been a court case in Kiev in which the Berkut riot police have been acquitted of shooting the demonstrators because they're defense lawyers were able to get evidence which was put through by Skype from Georgia, of people from Georgia who said that we were mercenaries and we were paid money, supposedly being paid money to carry out these, we shot both police officers and demonstrators from various various buildings which were under the control of Pravi Sector, which Perubi heads up. And the evidence in that court case shows that the people were shot not by the previous Yanukovych regime, but by people associated with the new regime, specifically Perubi and his cohorts. And they killed those people. And if you think about it, they're prepared to kill pro-EU demonstrators. Are they prepared to shoot down aeroplanes? Yes, especially if they're working closely with NATO intelligence services, which is clear that they are. So surely NATO intelligence services wouldn't do things like that. Well, I have to tell you, If you believe that, then I've got a suspension bridge to sell you. They have been doing that stuff for years, not
thing,
just in
Martin,
the Ukraine.
One of the key things to do with MH17 was that the Ukrainian air traffic control refused to release the audio transcripts.
Indeed. And the black boxes...
Well, actually, no, to be fair, they released some transcripts, but they wouldn't release the original audio, so various...
That's right.
Could
so
see
a transcript
edited,
without the original audio, it doesn't mean anything, does it?
I mean, if you release the audio of the conversations with air traffic control very easy then to detect if that has been edited.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. There is a procedure for investigating all of these kind of incidents. It's written into international agreements and laws. None of that procedure has been followed. Effectively, just like the Skripal case or the Duma chemical weapons attack that wasn't, basically what happens is NATO makes up its own stories and then presents them to the world as if that's the gospel truth, and anybody else who's saying anything else is clearly an evil liar, and we're the good guys, they're the bad guys, can't you see our white hats, can't you see their black hats? And of course it does enough to keep the ball rolling, but it doesn't convince anybody in Russia, I can assure you.
Somebody calling themselves Bellingcat has said that it has identified conclusively that 50-year-old Russian military officer Oleg Ivanikov was in charge of military operations in eastern Ukraine when the MH17 was shot down over separatist-controlled territory on the 17th of July 2014. He was on active duty in eastern Ukraine as an officer in the main intelligence directorate, GRU, of the general staff of the Russian Defense Military. He said he held the post during an undercover deployment into eastern Ukraine.
Well, I'm not suggesting that it may be that it was an undercover deployment. I don't know one way or the other. But the point is, they're claiming that it was a Russian missile battery. And the Russian missile batteries would have had to drive into East Ukraine. Don't forget, the Americans have got satellites and everything. It drove into East Ukraine, shot down the plane, and then drove back into Russia. Meanwhile, of course, you've got seven different batteries of exactly the same kind of missile, which have been deployed by the Ukrainians.
So anyway, who is this Bellingcat, and why is just a minute, and why is he telling this through Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty? Who are they?
Well, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty are essentially the propaganda arm of NATO in Eastern Europe. They always were in the Soviet era, they still are now. Bellingcat has actually got no credibility as a...
His real name is Elliot Higgins.
Yes, Elliot Higgins basically was made redundant from his job in IT or something, and then because he was bored, he sat at home on the internet and became an expert on military matters,
He's a verified news gatherer by Google. They've said he's definitely not fake.
Yeah, but he's being used to push these NATO lines on virtually everything to do with Syria and Ukraine, but he's actually got no background in any of this at all, and he's never been to any of these countries. It's a bit like the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is one guy working from his house in Coventry. What we've actually got here is a huge psychological warfare operation by NATO. Coming back to the original Maidan sniper attack, the Russians got hold of a telephone intercept which was verified by Agence France-Presse to be true, by Umas Piets phoning up Catherine Ashton, who was Umas Piets the Estonian foreign minister. They're very hostile to the Russians, so they had no reason to lie. Phoning Catherine Ashton saying, well, we've just been around the hospitals, and what everybody's telling us is that the people who carried out the murders were snipers associated with the new regime, not the old regime. And he confirmed to Agence France-Presse that the call was genuine. In other words, from the get-go, NATO have been playing fast and loose with everything.
Okay.
Killing people, killing innocent people, demonstrators, the people... counter-demonstrators in Odessa, a huge massacre there, and of course they shot down the plane in order to
make it the Russians look bad. Martin, why haven't the Russians made more of this?
The Russians have done everything they can to try and reasonably and calmly explain why what you're saying is nonsense. But the point is that if the whole point of this propaganda campaign is whatever Russian says, it must be wrong. Yeah? And there's plenty of stupid people out there. If the government tells them black is white, then black is white. Their knowledge of the matters is pretty limited. Their knowledge of what the Russians are or are not comes from James Bond's film they watch every Christmas, and that's about it. The reality on the ground in places like Ukraine is a long way from what Middle England believes.
We'll talk about Syria in a minute, but first North Korea and this summit being cancelled. Well, Moon Jae-in from South Korea is perplexed as Trump cancels a summit with Kim. One of the things I've not heard on any of the mainstream coverage is that Trump has pulled out of this just literally immediately after the North Koreans have supposedly destroyed their nuclear testing site. So he's waited until this nuclear testing site has all been destroyed. They've had various journalists there watching things being blown up. And now Trump says, I'm pulling out the summit now.
Well, what's happened is that Trump basically is a loose cannon. So what the South Koreans...
Well, there are suggestions that actually it's John Bolton that's...
Well, exactly,
sabotaged.
That's what I'm saying. That Trump's a loose cannon. What the South Koreans did was very smart. They went to talk to Kim Jong-un, and then the people who went to talk to Kim Jong-un said, right, we're going straight to talk to Donald Trump. So they didn't talk to any of Trump's advisors. They went straight to Trump himself and said, Kim Jong-un wants to meet you. And Trump said, oh, great, I'll meet him. And then, of course, you can imagine the deep state in the US went absolutely bonkers because they, you know, Trump's not supposed to make deals like that behind their backs without discussing it with them. So then Bolton and all these others have been, you know, twisting Trump's arm up his back to say, well, you've got to put a stop to this. And that's what happened. But I understand hearing the news earlier before I came out that Trump's now saying that maybe it's possible that he will meet with Kim Jong-un. So we will just have to see.
Maybe it's a bit of a tug of war going on with him and Mike Pompeo.
Well, what's happening is Trump is a chump. I wouldn't trust him to run a pizza stand, But the fact of the matter is, because he does everything off his own bat, it means that he's a loose cannon from everybody's point of view. He's a loose cannon from our point of view, but he's a loose cannon from the right wing deep state in
a
the
loose
US's
cannon
point of view
with
as well.
His finger on the biggest nuclear arsenal.
Well, yes,
history.
You might well say. I mean, I'm far more worried about his finger on the trigger than Vladimir Putin. Let's put it that way.
Also, we hear last night more strikes, almost certainly from Israel on Syrian Arab army positions, which are trying to fight ISIS, but it doesn't seem like the Israelis want them to.
No, and there's another attack. The Syrians have claimed that they were also attacked by American aircraft up in the northeast there. Well, I mean, the possibility of a world war around Syria is definitely there. And of course, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, years ago said on French TV, before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials, said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. The point is that NATO started the war in Syria. They couldn't pump Assad out. He won the 2014 general election in Syria. And we're now living with the consequences. 500,000 dead, millions of refugees. And we started it.
This is
and we all want to go home for a nice cup of tea.
This is all getting interesting, isn't it? Because we've seen big changes in Iraq last weekend with the elections.
Indeed.
There, and it seems as if the shift is taking place there between the pro-Iranian factions in Iraq are winning out, and the anti-Iranian factions are starting to lose at the polls. So we've seen today.
That's not quite true, actually.
We've seen today, actually, what we've seen is Iraqi jets striking ISIS positions in Syria now as well.
Yes, but what's actually happened in the Iraqi election is more interesting than that, because Muqtada al-Sadr, who led the uprising against the Americans after the war, he is actually both anti-Iranian and anti-American. He wants both the Americans and the Iranians out of Iraq. And he's also been chatting to the Saudis. But he's also supported by the communists and other secular groups. But he hasn't got enough forces to build a coalition on his own. And the other two big blocks in Iraqi politics are pro-Iranian. So in actual fact, Sadr's more distant position on Iran, basically Iraq is moving in a pro-Iranian direction, but Sadr isn't necessarily part of that. He's somewhat distant from that. But of course, he hates the Americans. He fought the Americans. He wants the Americans out.
Okay, so yeah, he was involved, wasn't he, when Paul Bremer shut down his newspaper? That was when the Shia insurgency started over there.
Yes, that's right. So he called that off, but his father was assassinated by Saddam Hussein, and all this stuff. You get the people in the West saying, oh my god, he's against us, he's our enemy. These are the people who fought Saddam Hussein. John Bolton never fought Saddam Hussein. George Bush never fought Saddam Hussein. Al-Sadr's family died in their prisons. They've got a right to decide who they want to run their country.
Okay, so we're going to hear now from Lucy Morgan Edwards. She was working for the UN and the World Food Programme in Afghanistan. And really, we're following up now on last week's special on the 9/11 attacks. So let's hear from her now.
My name's Lucy Morgan Edwards. I spent about 6 years off and on in Afghanistan, initially a year before 9/11, and a year before that I was in Pakistan. Initially I went there on holiday, actually, to Pakistan to visit a friend who was working for the United Nations. She was based in Islamabad, and her housemate was working in Kandahar and Herat and Kabul, and she invited me to go and work with her. So I went there in July, August 2000, and was working there at the height of the Taliban regime for the United Nations on water projects and urban reconstruction projects and so on. And that was a very complicated time when the Bush election was hung later that year in November 2000. And then the USS Cole was apparently bombed in Aden. People weren't sure whether the US were going to bomb in retaliation. We now know that that was probably a false flag to set up Al-Qaeda as the so-called perpetrators of 9/11. So I went back. I had to come back to the UK in early 2001 because of having to be evacuated from Afghanistan. And then I went back to the country after 9/11.
Can you paint a picture of what Afghanistan was like before 9/11?
Yeah, I mean, I was based in Kandahar and I spent time in Herat also. Kandahar is, of course, the so-called stronghold of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden was reputedly living up the road. I mean, I actually saw some of his Sudanese guards who came into the compound of my office. At the time, the country was in a severe drought and great poverty, but there was stability. And my staff in Kandahar, the Afghans in Kandahar, seemed to be actually quite pro the Taliban because they felt that they'd introduced stability, security, that people could get on with their business. They didn't have checkpoints run by warlords. They didn't have the drugs trade. And there was no corruption, really. But, I mean, of course, it was very, very poor. And there were rights abuses. There was still a civil war going on in the northeast. But essentially, in that part, in the south, it was much more stable than it is now and has been in the last 15, 17 years.
I mean, you talk about the drugs there. I mean, this has been a major player in the world, Afghanistan, in the drug trade. How have you seen that success or otherwise of drug lords and, I suppose, the international drug dealers of milking Afghanistan for all this opium?
Yeah, I mean, it's just totally ridiculous. I mean, the Taliban had actually got rid of the drugs. They were fairly harsh on farmers who wanted to plant opium, and so people weren't doing it.
I mean, are you saying that the British and the Americans, the NATO forces, weren't harsh?
No, they weren't harsh. I mean, they re-imported the warlords who'd been involved in the drugs trade in the early 90s. The CIA had encouraged them to plant poppy in order to fund the war against the Russians, as they'd done in Vietnam, Laos, and other places in Southeast Asia during the 60s. And it was basically a cardboard cutout of what was going on in those countries in the 60s. And the CIA has a long history, they used to call it Air America, of exporting drugs. It's used as off-the-books revenue. It's quite an important factor in the international banking system as well.
When 9/11 happened, you weren't actually in Afghanistan, but I imagine you were keeping quite a close eye on what was happening there.
I was, yeah. I was in the UK. I was in London, actually, when 9/11 happened. Saw part of it on the telly. And quite soon after that, I actually heard an MP in the House of Commons being heckled for daring to question the bombing campaign. So I contacted him. His name was Paul Marsden. I think he was a Lib Dem at the time. Well, he'd moved across to the Labour Party or vice versa. I said to him, look, if you want me to help you, if you visit the region, I'll guide you around. So I took Paul Marsden back to Islamabad and then up to the border areas, Spin Boldak it's called, in the sort of tribal areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And while I was there, I was offered a job by the World Food Programme, which is part of the United Nations. So I did that for 6 months, and then I went to Kabul and I worked as an election monitor on the first stage of the elections. And I saw how the Americans and the Brits essentially brought back these very unpopular warlords, many of whom had been rejected by the electorate, but were then foisted upon them. And in fact, the king was removed. He was a very popular figure. The Americans basically got rid of the king and forced the warlords back upon the people. And so I decided to become a freelance journalist. So I was out there until the beginning of the Iraq War, writing various articles for some publications. The Scotsman, The Economist, The Telegraph, and then I did the odd piece. I did a piece for the Sunday Times. I did one or two pieces for the Daily Mail, you know, whoever was going to pay, basically, and publish my pieces. But it was mainly The Scotsman and The Telegraph.
So, I mean, it doesn't sound very good, does it, on the face of it, that you've got a system that we may not necessarily agree with, being run by the Taliban. The Americans and the British come along, and then they reintroduce mob rule.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they were bringing in people who would just do what they were told and take the money. But the thing was, as soon as they planted the first crop of poppy and gone back to their fiefdoms, they weren't quite as easy for the Americans to push around. But I think essentially, I mean, the Americans had Karzai's brother in Kandahar, Wally Karzai, I think he was called, who was running a huge drugs operation throughout the south, Kandahar, Ghazni, and those various, there's an arc of cities through the south. And he was intimately involved with his acolytes or, you know, colleagues, you could say, who were other warlords. So, yes, I mean, and then later on, I worked for the European Union ambassador later in 2004-5, and we had reports of NATO allowing various drug hauls, allowing them to proceed across borders and so on. You know, they intercepted various drug laws and then calls were made perhaps to Kabul, but then they were allowed to go. And then, of course, you had the situation where NATO bases were established in the regions. So, say, one by the Germans, one by the Brits, the Norwegians, they, the Italians, they had their different bases. But they always teamed up with the local warlord. And when you had, a, say, for example, a British commander, who I think was deputy of NATO at the time I was there in 2005, flying in, the first thing he would do when he flew into one of these bases was go and have lunch with the local warlord. And at the time I heard that this particular warlord was expropriating people's property and kidnapping their children and committing all manner of human rights abuses. So these people were really unpopular with Afghans, but we teamed up with them and made them our allies. And you know, as they say, if you lie down with dogs, you get fleas. And that's the situation.
What about strategically? Because it's quite an interesting part of the world, that kind of right smack bang in the middle of Asia. Why do you think the US and the Brits have had such an interest in Afghanistan, other than obviously the drugs?
I mean, clearly it's nothing to do with democracy or women's rights, which you know, you'd have to need a lobotomy if you still believe that, despite all the relentless propaganda about free and fair elections and everything. It's complete and utter nonsense. It's just one massive, great military base now. I went back there in 2013. Yeah, I found it really shocking, the military, the militarized presence in Kabul, the watchtowers, the HESCO barriers. HESCO barriers, that's the kind of barriers, bomb blast barriers, that they use to protect their perimeter walls of their sort of different NATO offices and coalition forces command and so on. It's nothing to do with helping Afghanistan develop, but I think it's all about being a military base for the coming wars on Iran, China, potentially Russia. It's all about where it's located, which is, as we know, Lord Curzon said over 100 years ago, that it was the centre of the geopolitical chessboard of Asia.
This whole war on terror started with this invasion of Afghanistan. And a lot of people now are just pointing to this and saying, well, this is a sham. It's really just about regime change. It's about illegal intervention. So what do you make of the 9/11 attacks that brought about that intervention in Afghanistan, the British and American troops landing there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we have to do is go back to the paperwork of the neoconservative movement, which started with the clean break strategy in the 90s. Which was about balkanizing many of the countries in the Middle East. Then you had the Project for a New American Century, and their paper, which came out, was called Rebuilding America's Defenses. That came out a year before 9/11, and it talked about the need for a new Pearl Harbor in order to mobilize the types of military resources that were going to be needed to do the sort of transformation that they envisaged militarily in the Middle East. You've also got General Wesley Clark, who's the former Supreme Commander of NATO, whistleblowing in 2007, I think, to Amy Goodman, that he, or the Commonwealth Club in California, that he had seen a memo in the days immediate aftermath of 9/11 from one of his former colleagues, because he was retired at that stage, I think, indicating that they would be invading seven countries in 5 years. It's just overwhelming, really, the evidence that we have. And then, of course, when I was recently living in New York, I came across the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, and I read a lot of books, and I've seen a lot of documentaries, and I've attended conferences in New York where you have American whistleblowers and you have professional scientists, architects, and engineers saying that the official story of 9/11 does not add up scientifically. It contradicts Newton's laws. That they need to have a proper new investigation of 9/11, because there was never a proper investigation.
The same sort of thing happened with the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963, is that the real trail of the criminals is, you need to look at the cover-up afterwards, you know, and that the Warren Commission, again, was a similar sort of thing happened on September the 11th. Some people would argue, Lucy, that, you know, there was a 9/11 Commission report. Surely, I mean, these people were tasked with getting to the bottom of what happened.
Yeah, well, they tried to have Kissinger as the head of the 9/11 Commission report. Then they settled upon Philip Zelikow, whose PhD was titled On the Creation of the Public Myth. And this man wrote most of the 9/11 Commission report before he'd even got together with the rest of his commissioners or taken evidence. There were also reports of much of the evidence was completely excluded, a lot of complaints from families and so on. And then to top it all, most of the commissioners, some of them have written books saying that it was set up to fail, it was underfunded, and that it essentially it was completely bent, the whole process. It doesn't even mention Building 7, for example, which was the third skyscraper in the World Trade Center complex to come down that day. I mean, that's a bit like doing a report on a three-car pileup and only talking about two of the cars. It's a complete and utter farce, the 9/11 Commission report. It's not worth the paper it was written on.
Well, what do you think happened then?
Well, I think that it was a situation of pre-placed explosives in the buildings, possibly combined with mini nuclear weapons in the basements, because you have, I mean, the pile was burning for months afterwards, very, very, very hot. There are radionuclides present. The US Geological Survey had records of seismic events that happened immediately preceding the plane impact. I mean, it's a combination of pre-placed explosives and potentially much more powerful weapons. And, of course, the military-industrial complex, the deep state, the shadow government, whatever you want to call it, they work on a lot of technology that we, the public, have absolutely no idea what they're doing. I believe that people at the highest levels of the US government, in collusion probably with another external government, who played a very significant role, and, you know, as Christopher Boleyn says, it's in the cover-up that you find out who the perpetrators are. And so that would be the court cases or the lack of the court cases, the fact that the judiciary in New York appeared to be completely bent, the NIST report, which didn't properly address scientifically the reality of what happened. And in fact, the architects and engineers are contradicting that, and their papers have not been adequately responded to in academic circles. And then, of course, the 9/11 Commission report, which itself was a complete and utter sham. Plus, of course, the fact is the media, it was definitely a very high-level media operation as well. We know that Operation Mockingbird was a CIA operation to penetrate the mass media. And the problem is that the media is consolidated into far too few hands, and that there's a lot of cross-shareholding, if you like, between elements of the military-industrial complex and the deep state, which control the media.
You've used this term a few times, the deep state. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a very, very good YouTube documentary on this, which actually distinguishes between the deep state and the shadow government, by Kevin Shipp, who I think was a SHIPP, who's a former CIA. And he gives you examples of how McDonnell Douglas or Boeing are infiltrating even electoral processes in the United States. I mean, there's a great problem here in British academia in the UK as well. I mean, I did my PhD a couple of years ago, and I've been vaguely looking for academic jobs since moving back here. But when I look at academic jobs, I mean, academia is completely infiltrated. So you have academic positions at even, so for example, Brunel University in London, funded by Raytheon, which makes the missiles that we're using to bomb Syria at the moment. You know, talk about a conflict of interest. I see that there's been a huge drop from something like $7 billion in 2007 to $3 billion in funding for academia by our government. And the problem is with this is it means that you have these other interest groups that start to fund academic positions. That's a complete denigration of freedom of inquiry and freedom of sort of academic and intellectual thought.
Well, you're painting a picture here of a pretty horrific, not democratic, anti-democratic, totalitarian style West. Surely some of what you're saying should, you know, there should be some possibility of justice through the courts. I mean, I understand that Barbara Honecker has been making some efforts to do that. I know, in the US, and I noticed also that in a recent court case, Iran was accused of being behind the September 11th attacks in order to pay a vast fine to the US.
Yeah, I think that was I haven't looked into that in any detail, but I think that was basically just a PR sham. And that judge had a particular history of some other very bizarre judgment. I don't know on what he based that. But the problem with a lot of the court cases in the US was that most of the families were forced to settle out of court and to accept hush money. And that there has also been a massive clampdown on what they call legal discovery in the cases. So it's been very difficult for say one person bringing a case if they were trying to gain access to any of the files in the other cases. There seems to have been huge corruption presided over by judges with dual nationality in New York, so Israeli-American citizens. So the question is, can a man serve two masters? And to who is there real allegiance?
So what has Barbara been up to?
Well, Barbara's been very involved with, she was involved with the JASTA Act, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terror Act, which enables family members to bring a claim against any country that they consider might have been involved in the attacks on 9/11. It doesn't have to be limited to Iran. It could be any country. And she's now involved with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, which launched its dossier of evidence, because there is plenty of evidence now. So if people look for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry online, they will find this dossier of evidence. And Barbara Honegger, people should pay attention to her, because she has a great deal of experience, and she gives people advice as to what they can do in terms of making affidavits and taking evidence from potential witnesses themselves, because of course many of the witnesses unfortunately have died, some of them rather mysteriously since the attacks. But it's very important that evidence is compiled, and Barbara tells people how they can get some sort of official status with the court. It's rather a simple process in the United States.
Where do you see this heading? What's the ultimate point? What's the ultimate aim? Or is it just corruption feeding on itself?
I think the problem is, Tony, that it's got, and I'm sure you're aware, it's got to such a bad, bad degree of corruption. It's like we are being run. Our politicians are essentially organised crime. The conflict of interests, just to give an example, Theresa May bombing Syria without parliamentary approval. Her husband runs a huge hedge fund that has shares in the companies making the missiles. That is just the tip of the iceberg. 9/11 was also a massive financial crime, and there were lots of other crimes that were sort of essentially enabled to be covered up. At the very least, there was insider trading on the airlines, and there's been a paper published on this on United and American Airlines. Put options were placed, predicting that the share prices would go down. In fact, I don't think they were ultimately collected, but the Securities and Exchange Commission closed for 2 weeks after 9/11. That enabled millions of dollars, potentially billions of dollars worth of bond issues that were supposed to be coming mature the day after 9/11, which people suspect had been used in buying up large parts of Russian industry and so on in the late 90s. All of this was hidden because 9/11 was used to enact suspension of normal regulatory due process. So things were allowed to go through that normally would have had attention paid to them. There was other stuff going on with the companies and the buildings that were destroyed. There was something called Silverstream between AEG and Marsh McLennan. And then you saw some of the key actors. So what big clue, who were the first people on the TV screens? Who was the first person in BBC World Studios being interviewed by Nick Gowing? That was Eid Barak, who was the mayor of Jerusalem at the time. And the other person was Paul Bremer, who went on to become the first viceroy in Iraq, or the second viceroy in Iraq for George Bush. He had been head of Marsh McLennan. He is a very close associate of the Bush family. I mean, the things that just were not done, Tony. I mean, in a crime, first of all, you look for motive. Then you also look for, well, you follow the money, don't you? In the case of these buildings, you would ask who had control of the security of the buildings, so custody of the buildings, which organizations were controlling that security and who had access and so on. And many brave American researchers on 9/11 have actually done a lot of research that our media absolutely lamentably failed to do. A guy I know who used to be the BBC correspondent in New York, left in January 2001, I think. I said to him, do you realize that the Twin Towers were sold 6 weeks before 9/11? And he had no idea. I mean, that's the kind of important thing that the media should have told us, but they didn't. When people start researching 9/11 for themselves, they'll find themselves going on a journey where they are taken by surprise very often. For me, it has meant that I basically don't watch mainstream media. I'd never buy newspapers now. I'm much more about blogs, following people that I trust and respect, and financing alternative media, paying, supporting alternative journalists, freelancers who I respect. Yeah, I mean, that's for me a major wake-up or eye-opener has been the complicity of mainstream media with covering up the attacks.
I mean, actually, I suppose you could say they're kind of assisting terrorism.
Well, the BBC is certainly against its charter in withholding information about Building 7, for a start. I mean, there was a case, wasn't there, of, was it Tony Rook, who took the BBC to court, or they took him to court for not paying his licence, and he won, because he was able to show that the BBC has withheld information, which under its charter it's supposed to provide for the public. It's in the public interest that we are supposed to be informed. The BBC has failed lamentably. I mean, they even came up with this corker that they'd lost all their footage of 9/11. It was absolutely laughable. So I, for one, will not be paying my licence, and they can take me to court if they want. But I, you know, I'm absolutely sickened by their coverage of Syria, and I'm sickened by their failure to deal with 9/11. Yeah, I see them as a major part of the problem. Major part.
I mean, some people would say they're actually the spearhead of the war machine these days. But look, whereabouts do you think this is all heading? I'm just asking you to do a bit of crystal ball gazing.
I think it all depends, Tony, on how quickly people wake up. Because if they don't wake up, we could very well be in a situation where we have a nuclear war on our hands. People just need to wake up. People are very dozy in this country. I've come back to this country after 13 years away. I'm living in the countryside. It's like a country of sort of Joanna Trollope Argus sagas. People very kind of self-satisfied and pleased. I know there's another element to it, and that people are a bit more radical over in Bristol and so on, but people really need to wake up, but they don't want to, because even what I would consider progressive groups that I spoke to about my book in London have said to me, we don't want anyone talking about 9/11, because some of our group don't want to believe that that's the world that we live in. And I say to them, well, you're very selfish because you don't care about your grandchildren and the legacy that you are leaving them. You should know better. You're intelligent. You're middle class people, and you can put two and two together. But they want to keep their little beaks firmly in the sand. And if people continue like that, we're heading for doomsday, I mean, I'm afraid.
Can you blame people for wanting to stay in the comfort zone, not to leave the comfort zone?
Yeah, I do blame them, because I think everyone has a responsibility, particularly if you're well educated and you live in this country. Basically, if you don't want to inform yourself, your response, it's like silence, is you're an accessory to the fact. It may be in future days, grandchildren or whoever's left might say, and what did you do at the time when we could have all been waking up to this and averted the worst? So, no, I think silence is complicity.
Well, what she's saying there, Tony, reminds me of what George Orwell said when he came back from Spain, having been wounded fighting Franco. And he said, I got off the boat at Dover and I just realised that the deep, deep sleep of England was, they just weren't awake to what was going to happen to them. And of course, very soon after that, they were in World War II, but they could have realised what was going to happen if they'd opened their eyes in 1936.
And now, 1,000 points we could pick up on, really, from what she's got to say there, but one of them is this whole thing of university funding. A really good point, actually, that she's saying that less than half now, from 2007, money going into our universities. That means, of course, that private industry, big business, is now basically paying the wages of some of the major university professors out there.
Well, it's more sinister than that, because, of course, if you think about a company like Raytheon, they basically get their money from the taxpayers. They're not building a better widget there, are they? Then they use the profits they make from selling stuff to the taxpayers to pay for the university. So it's basically the public's money that's being used, but Raytheon are the middle men who are making sure that that everything comes out as they would like it to be, and the same thing's happening in newsrooms.
Now, Lucy Morgan Edwards also has been working much more recently in Afghanistan, so I thought I'd ask her about that. But just to apologise, there are a few blips caused by Skype blipping away in the background here, but let's have a listen to her take on the modern Afghanistan.
There are people there who are brilliant across the United States who've done research, who don't want to let this drop. But they're in a situation where their government has been captured by a cabal. It doesn't matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans. The people that run the country are not Donald Trump, for example. He's just the front man. He is not the problem. The problem is behind him. It's much deeper than him. And this has been going on since the killing of JFK in 1963. But a lot of people are just blinded by propaganda. But I think the younger generation might be starting to wake up because they're more into social media or using the internet. But obviously the powers that be are trying as much as they can to try to censor that. We're basically in a situation now where the powers that be are trying as much as they can to censor social media. So Facebook is clearly something that we all need to think about finding an alternative to. I saw last week that they've just teamed up with this dreadful neoconservative lobby group called the Atlantic Council, which is clearly a sort of Zionist special interest group. And sort of NATO group, and that they're going to be, the laughable headline was that they're using the Atlantic Council to assist in democracy. It's a bit like our military saying that they're going to go and do democracy and governance in places like Afghanistan. It's a complete joke. The military don't know how to do governance and democracy. I mean, it's just like, pull the other one. But they're trying to find a justification for their existence. You know, with Facebook, it's all getting very sinister.
Lucy, has this affected you, your life, your friends, your relationship with your family, that sort of thing, getting so interested in all this?
Yeah, completely. I feel like I start to feel that the people that I'm going to be close to are the people that can be bothered to roll up their sleeves and do the research for themselves. And they can start by looking at Building 7, the third building that came down that day that wasn't hit by a plane. Because when people can't be bothered to do that, and they take you at face value and think, oh, she's mad, but they can't be bothered to do the research for themselves, I don't have time for those kind of people anymore. You know, I'd rather spend my time with enlightened souls who do take responsibility, who are concerned, who have curious minds, and who, you know, take responsibility for the future of the planet and the future of their grandchildren.
Back to Afghanistan, because this poor little country seems to have been at the centre of so much over the last few months, weeks. There's been some absolutely horrific bomb attacks with sometimes hundreds of people being killed. Some of these bomb attacks have not killed any of the foreign soldiers that are in Afghanistan, just local people, which does seem bizarre. I mean, if they're being carried out by the Taliban, why are the Taliban attacking Afghans rather than the occupiers? That doesn't seem to make much sense to me. Just in one example, on April the 22nd, 63 people are killed at voter registration centres in Kabul on 27th of January. 95 were killed in a NATO go-home bomb blast. Back in December last year, a news agency car bomb killed 40 people. So this is happening all the time in Afghanistan. Yeah, yeah. What do you think? Is there anything that you think that will help people there?
Foreign troops should go home, and I think once they leave, the situation will get much better. This does not have the hallmarks of Taliban-style attacks. These attacks have the hallmarks of state intelligence agencies. So the question is, which country or countries are involved in that? It's very curious, I think, how we don't hear about Al-Qaeda now in Afghanistan. We hear about the Taliban, but Al-Qaeda seems to have morphed into ISIS. Again, it's just one of those bits of information that's just a little bit too ridiculous. We know that ISIS is probably linked to Site Intelligence, SITE Intelligence, in Bethesda, Maryland, which is run by Mossad agent Rita Katz, who's been accused by people like Christopher Bullin of putting out videos of beheadings and so on before Al-Qaeda or ISIS did it. And so I'm very suspicious about what's going on. I've also heard several times, both from Afghan commanders that I'd interviewed for my book on Abdul Haq when I was there in 2013, and also more recently by a very well-known, very legitimate source, British source, that the Americans are actually transporting terrorists and munitions around the country. So they're bringing them to the northeast. They're bringing them to places like Wardak. That's what I heard from the commanders south of Kabul. They're bringing them in from Pakistan or the border areas, or maybe even Turkey these days. God knows. That's where they train the white helmets, isn't it, in Turkey. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're transporting terrorists in from there as well. But it's just, it is not believable what's going on and the headlines that we're being fed anymore.
Just remind us about your book and who is this Abdul Haq chap?
Mm-hmm. So the title of my book is The Afghan Solution, The Inside Story of Abdul Haq, the CIA, and How Western Hubris Lost Afghanistan. It was published in 2011. And I basically researched it while I was working in Afghanistan. I came across the family of Abdul Haq. They were a well-known sort of freedom fighter, Mujahideen family during the 1980s. And Abdul Haq had, in the year before 9/11, assembled a group of tribal elders and some of the warlords like Massoud, and got them to agree that they would work in a sort of umbrella for peace below the figurehead of the former king of Afghanistan, and that they would then agree to topple the Taliban and bring about a new order. And in fact, the way that Afghans often do their battles is over tea and nuts the night before the battle, and that they agree to work then, and then there's actually no need to have a battle. And they'd, through tribal discussions and jurgas and so on, he had made these very significant alliances, so there was actually no need to have the war at all. And I followed the book through the lens also not just of the family and people I met and my own experiences of the lies that we were told about democracy and women's rights, but also through the perspective of a couple of American brothers who were trying to get support for Abdul Haq in Congress in the run-up to 9/11, and in fact in the 2 years before 9/11, and their story of what happened with the American side of it, and a couple of British guys, former SBS Marines, and another chap who's a cameraman who'd been trying to get support for Abdul Haq in MI6 and the Conservative Party. So I showed the perspective of what was going on in the British Parliament and in Washington, D.C., with these groups trying to get support for this guy who, by all accounts, had been a brilliant commander during the 1980s, was very moderate, was not beholden to the ISI or MI6 or the CIA for giving too many munitions. He was actually starved of them, but was very, very strategic in his battle against the Russians, and would have been the kind of person who could have brought about the type of Afghanistan that we really should have aimed for, instead of bringing in the drug family, the CIA-related drug family of Hamid Karzai, not allowing the king to come back in any shape or form, and bringing back the warlords, which were very unpopular with the Afghan people. And I had enormous trouble getting it published, Tony, and getting it reviewed. And I just thought, you know what? You'd think that the media might be interested in a fair-haired English girl who lived there during the Taliban and wandered around, who wasn't working for any particular affiliation. But no, I mean, all these former soldiers published their memoirs and got loads of reviews in the mainstream media, while I was completely ignored, and I had to really fight for every bit of coverage that I got. That, again, opened my eyes to the interest groups that shape the mainstream media.
Well, that's a very interesting interview, Tony, and of course I agree with virtually everything that she said. And, you know, people should obviously buy the book if they want to get more detail about Abdul Haq.
Let's get on to some real discussion about this. Because, look, we were saying slightly before this, Iran has apparently now got to pay $6 billion to the victims of the 9/11 attacks. This is the lawsuit that says Iran trained the September 11 hijackers, but the official investigation found no evidence of Iranian involvement. But the courts say differently. This was on the 1st of May this year in the US.
Well, as she said, this is a complete PR stunt. There's no evidence. The Iranians are Shia Muslims. They are absolutely sworn enemies of Al-Qaeda. And in fact, Al-Qaeda has carried out attacks inside Iran because the Iranian secret services and military are a constant alert about Saudi-backed attempts to destabilize their regime. So the idea that they would be behind the 9/11 attacks, it's like saying that the UDA is the IRA. It just doesn't make any sense. The UDA isn't the IRA, and the Iranians are not Al-Qaeda.
The US stabilization program in Afghanistan, getting back to the main subject of this evening's investigation, Afghanistan, is a $5 billion failure, apparently. The US Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, that's SIGAR, has today issued a report, on Thursday, the report concluded the 15-year, $5 billion Afghan stabilization has been a failure. Concluded the US had unrealistic expectations for the timeline of stabilising the country, and that the money has been wasted.
Well, it's not been wasted if you are the military-industrial complex, as the purpose of this is to create a massive drugs industry, because they use that money to fund stuff elsewhere. And think about the strategic location of Afghanistan. They don't care what happens to the ordinary Afghans, but they've got plenty of nice bases there, which most of the drugs come through those bases. They're obviously flown out on military aircraft. But their bases are there to intimidate the Chinese, the Iranians and the Russians, and also to keep the Pakistanis in line, and the Indians have got a finger in this pie as well. So in other words, Afghanistan's a big misfortune throughout history, modern history, is to be the battleground for everybody
Lucy's talking there a lot about potentially Israeli involvement as well. Britain has announced we've had all this, the horrendous stuff we covered briefly last week, the shootings in Gaza, 5,000 injured and 80 dead. The UK is selling $444 million worth of arms to Israel now, including sniper rifles.
Pounds, I think it was.
Dollars.
It was dollars, was it? Well, yes, including sniper rifles, which have been used to shoot 500 people in the head in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Well, if you watch the film Charlie Wilson's War, the Israelis are approached at some point in the film because they need to supply the Mujahideen with Russian or Soviet weaponry so that they can hide the fact that they're doing this. And of course the Israelis provided all the Soviet weaponry that they'd captured from the Syrians, which was then given to the Mujahideen to fight the Russians and to set up Al-Qaeda.
With the Rohingya, apparently the Rohingya are being supplied by the Saudis and the Burmese government by the Israelis. So anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, our sister show Dialects, on next Tuesday at noon. This show's story links and comment page is thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable and well-deserved bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.